Welcome to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights Podcast. I'm your host, Shalay Hendrickson, Head of Healthcare here in Bermuda. On today's podcast, we're going to focus on the impact of cannabis legislation on healthcare systems. I have the privilege of sharing this podcast with Eric Berlin, partner and co-head of the cannabis group at Dentons US LLP. Eric helped draft and pass Illinois and Ohio medical cannabis laws. He spends 100% of his time on clients in or impacted by legal cannabis or hemp CBD industries. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much, Shalay, and nice to talk with you today.
To get us started, can you briefly give us a breakdown on the differences of the following terms: cannabis, hemp, and marijuana?
Yes, I can. And it's very important to understand these terms because we have different laws applying to different aspects. So let me take just a little bit of time to explain that. There is the plant family, Cannabis sativa L, and that is the family that houses all of those terms that you just referred to. Marijuana is actually slang for cannabis. Cannabis is more the scientific term. And marijuana actually is somewhat considered a derogatory term, but we don't need to get too hung up on that today. Either term will work. The cannabis flowers and leaves have glands that contain, and I'll explain these terms in a moment, cannabinoids, terpenes, flavonoids, and other plant matter. So let's start with cannabinoids. There are approximately, very roughly, 100 identified cannabinoids. The best known one is THC, and that is what is in the drug, provides the euphoria that people who've used it are familiar with or know of it, have heard about. But there are many other cannabinoids, like cannabidiol, which is CBD, receiving a great deal of attention recently, CBG, CBC, CBN, plus, as I mentioned, many others. And these uniquely combine with our endocannabinoid receptors in the human body. So we'll turn back to cannabinoids in a second. Terpenes give cannabis the smell, and flavonoids give some of the flavor. And the mixture of cannabinoids, terpenes, and flavonoids give the different strains of cannabis their different smells, tastes, and effect. So turning to hemp now, hemp is just a type of cannabis. It's within that Cannabis sativa L plant family. And hemp is defined as having no more than 0.3% THC by dry weight as measured as specified by the USDA regulations. So what I'm saying there is hemp, the dividing line between hemp and what the US government considers now illegal controlled substance of marijuana is the 0.3% THC. That, however, is defined by the government, not by nature. These plants are all part of the same plant family. Hemp tends to be generally high in CBD, and that is extracted and included in various products for various applications and purposes. And in fact, the FDA has approved CBD as a drug in the form of GW Pharmaceuticals' Epidiolex, which is the brand name for cannabidiol, which is CBD. And in fact, a drug with CBD and THC is part of the FDA testing and approval process as things now. So to be clear on that, we're talking about one plant family. The division between hemp and the rest of cannabis is the 0.3% dividing line for THC. The cannabis strains on the medical or adult use / recreation markets tend to be higher in THC, while the strains from hemp tend to be higher in CBD.
All but four states have legalized cannabis in some form. Explain to our listeners the impact of cannabis legislation on medical malpractice for doctors and hospitals.
Despite some of the fuss we're seeing about this, we're actually not seeing any significant development of medical malpractice cases based on cannabis recommendations or certifications. Now, I know that many doctors still remain hesitant to certify patients for the U.S. state medical cannabis programs. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that doctors have a U.S. constitutional right to recommend cannabis or suggest a patient try cannabis. And we haven't seen any relevant division point saying that that's permitted, but signing a certification is not. So, of course, we're really not seeing a significant spike in medical cannabis patient cases here. Recommendations, though, have to be within the generally recognized practices or whatever the state's medical malpractice standard is, which remains fairly broad for cannabis as things currently stand. But doctors do need to be cognizant that if they are making a recommendation or a certification, it has to be consistent with state law and consistent with how cannabis is generally used. And I think too often, actually, doctors certify a patient and let the patient just run with it. And I think it's much more natural for doctors to then check in on dosing, check in on whether patients are having side effects. But I know some are hesitant to do it, but the bottom line is we have not seen a great uptick in medical malpractice cases relating to cannabis.
So some hospitals allow inpatients to use medical marijuana. Some say that the patient will have to administer it themselves, while others require a medical professional to administer the medical marijuana. What legal challenges do you think these policies would attract, if any?
The tension here is that a hospital is supposed to control and administer all controlled substances. But under federal law, cannabis is a controlled substance, but it's also illegal. So the tension that hospitals have is, how do we permit patients to use this, particularly if it's part of their normal medical regime? So, for example, an MS patient that literally is unable to get up in the morning or move without taking some cannabis to help relieve some of the cramps in the legs. And not being able to do that in the hospital is problematic. But at the same time, a hospital has problems taking possession of the cannabis and then administering it, which is not what the hospitals can do. So many hospitals will look the other way on this. The trick is that the cannabis, there can be interactions with other drugs. For example, CBD has been found to elevate certain drug effects in a similar way as grapefruit does. And cannabis as a whole can have interactions with anesthesia, such that they're finding that sometimes more than the normal amount of anesthesia is necessary to sedate a regular cannabis patient. So on this subject, I would say that hospitals are sort of trying to figure their way forward to deal with the situation. What is critical as they look the other way is they don't entirely ignore that a patient may be a cannabis user, because it can have interactions and impacts on other drugs and treatments.
Eric, when I ask some risk managers about this exposure, many say that they don't allow their physicians to certify medical marijuana because they're afraid of it impacting their federal funding. So can you explain to us why hospital employees that certify patients to utilize cannabis does not in fact conflict with federal healthcare laws or federal funding?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Federal law, in fact, does not preclude a medical professional from recommending cannabis to a patient or signing state certifications for patients to qualify for medical cannabis. And in fact, we have not seen any adverse consequences for doctors or medical professionals under this scenario. Although there are laws about physicians not having an interest in state cannabis licensees. And of course, physicians or medical professionals have to act otherwise legally under the law. So if they are, for example, certifying and helping a company launder money, that's a problem. But in terms of strictly making a recommendation or suggesting that a patient check out cannabis or even signing state-required certifications, we have not seen any adverse consequences for the doctors or medical professionals that are simply doing that. So I think that the fear of adverse consequences obviously is far greater than the reality here. And I should mention also that we have, at least I don't know of an example of a hospital losing federal funding because someone in the hospital recommended cannabis.
Eric, let's switch gears slightly here. What would you say are some of the initial concerns with hemp and CBD products?
Because many CBD products are sold outside the state regulated and tested cannabis programs, the products are, and the sales of them are largely unregulated. And I would say that actually is the biggest problem because that raises concerns about adulterants in the products, inaccurate ingredient lists, and false claims. For example, CBD products sometimes have been found to contain no CBD or claim miracles like cures Alzheimer's, right? And that's problematic. The drug itself, the molecule itself, CBD, actually has a very good safety profile. The FDA placed Epidiolex, which is the brand name for cannabidiol, which is CBD, on Schedule 5, which is reserved for the safest drugs, and hemp and extracts of hemp have been removed entirely from the Controlled Substances Act. That said, Shalay, the FDA has focused on a few areas of medical concerns when they issue guidance and have generally spoke about this. And that falls into four buckets. The first is high doses of CBD resulting in elevated liver enzymes. And it's not entirely clear to me the full adverse health consequences of that or what the dosing needs to be, but it's something that the FDA is looking more closely at. The second is the potential impact on male sexuality and reproduction. And there hasn't been a tremendous amount found there. And I confess being a little bit cynical on that because I know that's a good way of getting a large population to back off of a drug or substance is tell males that it'll mess with their sexuality. So we'll see what actually comes there. The third area is interaction with other drugs. And I mentioned that's similar to how grapefruit might work. If you take certain drugs, you'll be told not to take grapefruit because it actually can amplify the effects of the drug that you're taking. The fourth area, and it's one that I think in many ways the FDA has been most concerned about because CBD actually has a very good safety profile, is patients opting out of traditional treatments like chemo for using CBD alone. You know, they'll read somewhere that CBD helps with cancer or helps with their child's autism and decide to forego any other treatment and just use CBD. And when you're getting treatment for something like cancer, that can be a concern. I should mention that most of these areas are not true outright dangers. They're almost more things like we need to warn about these things and in certain conditions have people get tested, for example, for elevated liver enzymes. So I think the biggest risks are unregulated product containing adulterants or untrue statements, or a lack of education on CBD and patients thinking that it will accomplish more than it's yet been proved to do.
Eric, I could relate to that because just under 2 years ago, my brother unfortunately was diagnosed with brain cancer. And although he did the radiation, he opted out of the chemo treatments because basically what he read online is that there was no correlation between chemo and brain cancer. So he actually went the route of using CBD oil. And while his doctor couldn't advise him to continue that, they said that other patients who have used the CBD oil have actually had some relief. So.
Absolutely. We may find that some of these really do work, but all I can do at this point is go with what we have proof for. And I'm not suggesting all conditions for cancer, but for some, there are what we consider traditional treatments that work. For example, for certain leukemias, there are now drugs that really keep it in check very well. And for people to say, I'm not going to take this drug, I'm just going to take CBD, may not be the best thing for them. So there may be some caution that's involved. And the science on all of this will evolve, no doubt.
So there seems to be a small push to get Medicare to cover cannabis. Where do you think this will go?
Well, I certainly read about this. I believe that it's very unlikely for Medicare to cover medical cannabis until the U.S. government legalizes or decriminalizes cannabis. And putting aside CBD, and that'll only get tested where it's proven. So, for example, with pediatric epilepsy and perhaps some other conditions coming online. But with cannabis writ large, first of all, I don't think we're going to have any legalization or decriminalization, at least until after the 2020 presidential election. And quite frankly, it may take several years for that to happen. I do think that as time goes on, there will be an additional push for this. So while I'm skeptical of that happening in the short term, and I would bet against it, there are data indicating that expanded private and public insurance coverage, or expanding that to medical cannabis, would help patients and reduce costs. And so I think a lot of this will be data-driven. And as we continue to see in state programs, for example, that have more liberal legalization programs, pharmaceutical insurance claims related to conditions that are treated by cannabis have in fact declined. So if something like that holds up, and at the point that cannabis does get legalized, I would think that private and public programs would be very interested in that as a way to lower their costs. But really, I don't see it happening until we get farther along on federal legalization.
Eric, so far we touched on whether or not hospital systems allow their physicians to certify patients. But what about the flip side? How can healthcare systems avoid discrimination suits by employees who are cannabis users?
Shelley, that's a great question. And it's actually an area that's kind of starting to evolve now. The bottom line on that is any of these employers in any state need to follow state law. And the problem that we have with cannabis is that many state laws differ, even on this subject of how do we treat employees. Some states continue to authorize zero tolerance testing for CBD, and other states protect medical cannabis patients more, but generally not if they're in safety-sensitive positions or ones in which the U.S. government mandates zero tolerance. But we're also seeing, so that's the law. The law says in some of these states, even for medical cannabis patients, you can maintain zero tolerance testing. Other states, like I'll take Oklahoma, does not permit an employer to apply zero tolerance testing to a medical cannabis patient. So there's greater protection for the medical cannabis patient. What I started to say just before is that we're actually seeing an evolution of this in part due to state laws that are legalizing cannabis, some increased usage by adults, and low unemployment rate. So for certain positions like computer programmers in Colorado, they've been able to push back and say, I'm not going to take this job if you have zero tolerance testing. And I like to use cannabis on a Friday night or whenever I like to use it, but I don't use it before coming into work, and I'm come into work fully capable of doing whatever I need to do. So you can either hire me and scrap that policy, or I'll go find a job elsewhere. That is causing certain employers to back off of strict cannabis testing, as well as the fact that some of these employers over time are cannabis users themselves. And so they're saying, why would I have this policy? It seems hypocritical to me. I don't have zero tolerance testing for alcohol. Why should I have it for cannabis? So it's a tricky issue, but one that is evolving based on the law and the realities of the work marketplace.
Eric, states that have recently legalized cannabis have seen a steep influx of patients in the ED that are suffering from overutilization of cannabis. What can hospitals do to prepare for this patient population, or what should they consider?
Well, a few things, Shelley. First of all, obviously those incidents are unfortunate. and can be mitigated by better education and by all cannabis users being responsible for other ones. So, you know, those are often happening where someone hasn't used cannabis ever or for years and is going in and taking like a 50 milligram edible. And it's going to be an uncomfortable situation for them, but it's one that basically in most situations they can just sleep off. So the numbers of increased visits to ERs is skewed a little bit because some folks who previously had used cannabis under those circumstances, they may have gotten it off the black market. Cannabis was illegal. They would not have gone to the ER. So the increase in ER visits is both the legality of the drug enabling folks to go to the ER and feel like they're not going to get arrested, but also certain users that may not have used cannabis for a long time and now because it's legal, giving it another try. So number one, those folks need to make sure they're staying on low dosages. Dispensaries can educate a lot of folks on that. And so I don't mean to demean or to minimize the unpleasantness of that experience, but almost all of those medically can be dealt with by the person simply lying down and getting rest and just staying calm for a little bit of time and the effects wear off. So we're not talking about people dying or people entering disease states because of this. They just need to rest it off, and sometimes they get scared and go to the ER instead.
Eric, I would like to thank you for joining us on this podcast today. You have provided us with insights on cannabis litigation for healthcare systems that I trust will be useful to our listeners.
Well, this has been a great pleasure, Shalay, talking with you, and I thank you very much, and I'm honored to take part in the podcast.
Thank you very much. So thank you for listening to the AXA-XL Healthcare Risk Insights podcast. Stay tuned for future podcasts where we'll dive into other current and developing risks impacting the healthcare industry.